Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water, straight from your kitchen tap. Today we're talking about the future and the environment. So Cooker, I suppose, is a perfect match this week. Rather than boiling a kettle every time you need hot water, Cooker keeps the water hot at all times using a vacuum. So you save energy by not constantly heating it up. Right, okay, how this works, as you can tell, I have absolutely no idea. I honestly have no idea how a vacuum is keeping your water hot. Also, I don't know how, when the cold water comes in, how it then gets heated up to join the hot water, but the hot water is in a vacuum. But look, let's face it, if I was transported back to the caveman times, I could probably just about make a fire. I could make a wheel for them. I couldn't make the combustion engine. I still have absolutely no idea how TV works, and I'm on the bloody thing, so I just don't know how it works. I talk in one part of the country, and then people can watch me wherever they want in the country. Anyway, for more information, go to cooker.co.uk. I love my tap. If you can afford it, or you're doing your kitchen up, whatever, I'd get one. I think they're brilliant. Today's podcast, I'm curious about artificial meat or alternative proteins. My guest is Chris Wadrup, who's general manager at CPI. They're a company that's supporting innovation across the food chain. I'll read a bit of bump, actually, from their website, so you know what you're dealing with here. At CPI, we understand that emerging trends in food and drink are directly influenced by societal changes, from increased global demand to health and environmental concerns and animal welfare. We use our technical expert, industry know-how, and dedicated facilities to help you keep up with the ever-changing demands from the consumer and to drive innovation across the product supply chain. They also go on to say, CPI acts as a catalyst, bringing together academia, businesses, government, and investors to translate bright ideas and research into the marketplace. We do this by giving our customers access to the right experts, equipment, networks, funding, and more, connecting the dots for effective innovation. So Chris Wadrup sounds like the perfect person to speak to, because I want to know where we are going with artificial meat, lab meat, all the variant different types of things. And this is the guy who's getting this stuff to market, or helping them get to market. Let's meet him. Here's Chris. Chris, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm very well, Tim, thanks. I'm enjoying the beautiful sunshine. Just had my dog out for a walk and took half an hour away from the computer.
Perfect. By the time this goes out, it'll be rainy again, though. I think we'll have had our week of sunshine. I've just sort of done a brief introduction of what you actually do. I think it's quite a good idea if you can explain a bit about yourself. But just before that, how has the pandemic hit your industry, trying to get stuff to market?
It hasn't, in terms of we've had one of our busiest years. In terms of what we do, we work for people that are taking products to market. So we're a service provider to people that are doing the scale-ups and trying to provide samples and whatever else. So we've been incredibly busy. I mean, we shut down for a day. And that was the day that Boris made his announcements last March, simply because we weren't entirely sure what he was going to say. So we sent everyone home and just said, look, if you can work from home, great, do so. If you can't, take a day off until we know what Boris is saying. And then if all's been well, we sent texts out to everyone and got everyone back into work. Because a lot of our team work in laboratories or on pilot plants. So it isn't stuff they can do from home, because, you know, we're not allowed to take experiments home. But half the team do work off laptops and whatever else the majority of the time, and can do it from their home offices. So we've only been disrupted for a day. in the last sort of 15 months. And a lot of our customers have found that as a godsend, because a lot of universities shut down completely for like 6 to 8 months over that, over that period. And it really slowed down some of the research and development in the UK, but customers were able to come to us and get the kind of services that they needed to keep them on their path to commercialization.
So, Chris, you live in the future, because you're always looking at the future. Do you get, just before we get stuck into artificial meat or lab meat and all the other different varieties, do you get frustrated looking at politics and politicians? Because I find that since I've been doing this podcast, I love looking at the future. And I always think when we get to an election, I'm always like, when are they talking about the big things like global taxation or something? You've just seen that with the G7 or AI or what the hell we're going to be eating. It's always like they're dealing with such old-fashioned crap where the world is changing so dramatically. I've never even heard a politician talk about cryptocurrency. You know, I'm sure they are, but they're not. Boris is not going on about it, or Jeremy Corbyn or Keir Starmer. I'm like, it's so strange. And the world of food that you're dealing with, you're seeing the future slowly develop. Do you get frustrated that the politicians aren't more maybe aware of it, or maybe interacting with it, or are they?
They are, to the best of my knowledge. The challenge is these things take years to evolve. Technology takes years to evolve and adapt and then be implemented, whereas a typical parliament's 5 years. So if you allow them the first year to get, you know, just to figure out, Christ, we're in power, what are we going to do? And then, you know, a couple of years to actually do it. And then the final year is like, oh, right, we've had 4 years. Now let's figure out how we get to stay in or do whatever else and fight the challenge. So they're working on very different horizons relative to some of the challenges that you're talking about. So this thing net zero and we're going to be carbon neutral by 2050. I mean, that's a whole separate podcast, but that's like five parliaments away. That's five governments away. So expecting the guys now to be able to grasp what needs to be in place and that the next lot that come in won't just change it. You know, you really need cross-party politics to work on these long-term visions and have 20 and 30 and 40-year plans in place where they agree, this is the plan and we're going to deliver it irrespective of who sits in number 10 and number 11. And that's the real challenge.
Yeah, I totally get that. So what you're basically saying, Chris, is we need a dictatorship. We need Kim Jong-un or something. If we want to move into the future, there's no point in having democracy, is there? Let's get rid of that crap. And basically put me in power and I'll get it sorted.
A load of my friends will say, yeah, that's probably what he is saying. I'm left wing Genghis Khan when it comes to some of this stuff.
Yeah, let's get involved in this then. Let me tell you my interest. I've already spoken to you because we had a little chat to see if this was a good idea for a podcast. And I believe it is. But I work on a cooking show and I've been watching the world develop. I did a podcast once on the most expensive, a little mini documentary on the most expensive burger, which was a laboratory made burger years ago. And the guy talked about it and he said it's a lot to do with animal welfare. Working on a cooking show, I'm watching things change. We're getting away from the idea of eating rabbit ever on a cooking show again, because people are not... I keep on looking at things like legs of lamb when they come onto the show and octopus and stuff like that. And I think it looks too much like the animal. And I mean, look, I still eat meat and I eat everything. I'm an omnivore. However, I am noticing that the world's changing and we kind of like our meat to be in squares in plastic. And that way we don't know what it is. And we don't sort of, yeah, we're worried about animal welfare. And I keep on thinking, when are we going to end up with just like tofu, basically, of the meat world, just lumps of meat, and then we can just put our own sauces on it. And I don't think we're a million miles away from it, but when I spoke to you, I realised there's a lot of different avenues going down that protein world at the moment. And so I thought we could investigate a few of them. We might as well start with plant-based, which is the one that everybody talks about the most at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, just picking you up on that, as part of my research, this trying to get my head around it, because like you said, I spend part of my life or a big chunk of my life in this sort of field. And I thought I understood it, but researching this to so I could sound semi-knowledgeable for you. It sort of opened my eyes to a bunch of different things. So I actually class it in that there's five different groups of that summarize what you're just talking about there. And if I just explain what the five groups are, and then you can ask me any questions about it. So the first group is exactly what we just said, is plant-based protein. That's your soya. That's your what a large part of the planet population currently live off. Pea-based proteins and all sorts of other bits and pieces. Then you get a thing called microbes that we can produce that we use for animal feed. Then you have microbes for animal products. So microbes that will produce, in the way that we brew beer and we make alcohol, you can brew the casein and whey protein that you would normally get from milk that you can use to manufacture cheese. So you can actually brew these food products from microbes in the same way we brew beer.
Is that corn?
No. Corn is the next class.
Right, okay.
So corn is the fourth class. So right. Corn is microbes and fungi. And when I say fungi or fungi, it's not the mushrooms that you would grow in the garden. This is sort of mycelia. It's a bit like a microbe. It's just a more complex organism. That's corn, but it's still fermented. You're still brewing it. But instead of it being a byproduct like alcohol is from yeast when you're brewing beer, the product is actually the cell. It's the microbe or it's the fungi itself. And what you do is you just multiply it and you just grow it in the fermenter and you take a little bit off and it continues to grow and you take a little bit off, take that away, concentrate it up, and that's your corn. That becomes your product that you then go add flavorings to and cook, and that becomes your product. So that was the fourth class, and that's in the human food chain. And then you have, which is the cellular agriculture piece, which is where we first started talking about it, which is where you're actually creating lab-based meat. So this, the DNA analysis is chicken, is pork, is beef. It is cells from an animal that have been grown into burgers or chicken fillets or whatever else it would be. And they're all at different stages in the market adoption and market application. And they all have different price points and they all have different challenges in terms of being able to produce it at thousands or hundreds of thousands of tons scale to have an impact globally.
Okay. So I got this article out from December 2020. It's from the BBC News, which said Singapore has given regulatory approval for the world's first clean meat that does not come from slaughtered animals. The decision paves the way for San Francisco-based startup Eat Just to sell lab-grown chicken meat. Okay, and then it goes on to say, according to Barclays, the market for meat alternatives could be worth $140 billion. Dollars, that's 104 billion pounds within the next decade. I'm sure you've got some figs on that, or about 10% of the 1.4, what's that trillion, do you think that is, global meat industry? And I'll just do another couple of bits from here. It says the company called it a breakthrough for the global food industry and hopes other countries will follow suit. So Singapore seems to be the only ones so far have put this on. And then it says Eat Just, that's what's
going to be. Yeah, Eat Just, yeah.
Previously said it would sell lab-grown chicken nuggets for $50 each. The cost has since come down, but it would still be expensive as premium chicken. So, I mean, we're starting to see this market emerge just because one country's agreed it, so I'm sure some others will.
So if you start with your numbers, so yeah, a trillion, and I don't really think it matters whether it's pounds or dollars once you start talking at a trillion, unless it's your national debt, because it's not a number that's meaningful to anyone. And that's one of the challenges here in terms of the size of some of these numbers are just ridiculous to hold in your head. So a trillion is the value of the meat market, whether it's dollars or pounds, I don't think it matters. And I looked at Just Eat, and Eat Just is the company's name, because that's really confusing because we've got the takeaway services in there.
Yeah, exactly. Just Eat.
So getting my head around that was a bit of a challenge. And they're advertising that they're selling these chicken portions, chicken nuggets, in a private members club in Singapore called 1880. The $23 a portion, which is about the price that you pay for a plate of food in a high-class restaurant. When I say dollars a portion, that's Sing dollars. So it's about 12 quid a portion for chicken, which is what you'd pay for a restaurant in the UK and certainly in London. I've looked at the menu. I couldn't find them, but they may still be there somewhere. My instinct is that's a loss leader. right now, for that technology, I understand how that's made. That's a company that have gone through the approval process in Singapore, which is phenomenal. To get it into the market is phenomenal. That is a world first. Putting it into a prestige place where people with a very discerning palate can go and buy a plate, phenomenal. But it's a loss leader. There's no way that that's a 11 quid for a few chicken nuggets at the minute.
Yeah, but if it's starting there, it's going to come down soon in price.
Oh, absolutely.
See, yeah. I love the idea of, I mean, I like the idea of nondescript protein or alternative proteins. I've eaten meat all my life, but there is something which, when I interviewed the guy who made the most expensive burger in the world, Lab Meat, I asked him why he did it. And he said it was all about animal welfare. We're getting, as humans, we're getting less and less interested in slaughtering animals. We don't like it. And we also want to care about how they're kept. And as we know, farming is not, it can be, but it's not the best way to treat an animal often, is it? And so that can become a problem. Now, I've been very interested in the idea of eating lab meat for quite a long time because of that little documentary I did. I was interested. You sent me a load of links. Thank you so much. Because I've learned so much reading all this stuff as well. And what's interesting about the lab meat people, Mosa Meat was one of the ones you said. It says pioneering a cleaner kind of way of making beef. Hi, we're Mimosa Meat, a European food technology company that's helping everyone take a bite out for a better future, starting with the world's kindest beef burger. And then it goes on to say, craving change. We want to introduce a new way of thinking about growing, making and enjoying food. The next step, which is kinder for all of us and the planet, but doesn't mean sacrificing taste. And that's the one thing that I think where lab meat might have a run on the other proteins is people seem to like the taste of meat. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And to be fair, just like you said yourself, I eat meat. My family eat meat. It's part of our diet. It's something that I do almost on a daily basis. So I'm by no means a Bible basher about veganism or vegetarianism. It's interesting though, in terms of the challenges. So if you look at a typical steak, if you think of a cell, yes, a cell is what you compose of as yourself or what a piece of meat is. In a typical piece of steak, there's all types of different cells because there's the muscle cell, there's the fat cell, there's the ligament and tenuous sort of fibrous bits that you get in there that add to some of the flavor and texture that hold and bind a thing together. The complexity, if you think you grow each of these cells individually, the complexity to then bind them all together is an entirely different technical challenge on top of the challenge of growing the cells in the first place. But going back to your question about meat taste and go all the way back up that chain that we talked about at the beginning in the five different organizations, five different classes of company or in the market, the plant-based industry has started promoting plant-based meat because a company called Impossible Foods back in 2011 did the research to understand why does meat taste like meat? And they came up with this thing called a heme protein, which is part of a blood cell. It's part of, it's an iron complex. It's why meat tastes like meat. And what they've been able to do is reproduce that. They took a sample, they took the DNA from a soya plant, soya root nodule, built it back into a microbe yeast. So basically they're brewing this material, this heme protein, capturing it, recovering it, blending it with meat. And that's why now you can buy an Impossible Burger that's basically 100% plant or microbial based, that bleeds like meat when you cook it and it turns brown and it has that meat taste. And that's it's science fiction. But these guys spent 5 years working on it, developing it, got it into the market, and you can buy Impossible Burgers in your supermarket.
Before I talk to you, I just assumed that marketplace would just fall away and it would just be lab meat because that's what I thought people would want. Now, I'm changing my mind dramatically after having just a quick conversation with you the other day. The other one you sent me, just so you can see how these lab meat companies are selling themselves, because I think it's quite interesting the way they're doing it. The other one you sent me was Higher Steaks. And on their website, they say, imagine a world where our meat doesn't contain antibodies. Oh, sorry, antibiotics.
Yeah.
Imagine a world where our meat is sustainable. Imagine a world where our meat doesn't require slaughter. And I thought those three statements were really strong. I thought they've done well there, because one of the things we hate is the fact that certain parts of the world, I think we're pretty good in the UK with our meat, but they pump hormones and antibiotics in the meat. And I think in our society, it's a problem with the antibiotics because we're becoming immune to them because we're having so many pumped into the animals. So I hear, I mean, I'm not a scientist expert. Imagine a world where the meat is sustainable. Great way of selling it that, you know, I'm sure it has a carbon footprint, even laboratory meat, but less. And then imagine a world where it doesn't require slaughter. That is huge. You don't have to kill a lovely sheep or a lamb, a baby sheep, to eat lamb. And I think it's a strong message they're giving there, isn't it?
And what you're talking about there, it's emotional, it's evoking different emotions when you're capturing the pictures of the lambs romping through the fields on bright shiny days and stuff like that, relative to what you see in a supermarket, which is, you know, yesterday I made bolognese and you used half a kilo of beef mince, half a kilo of lamb mince, just mixed it together. Look, nothing like the animal.
Yeah.
So there's a complete detachment from society to the industry that provides its food. And if people are like my wife, they don't want to understand what the industry is. She just wants her plate of food based on either visiting the local supermarket or taking it out of the fridge and then doing the cooking. And that's the challenge. And one of your guests the other week that was talking about the drugs and the drug policies, he talked about social change and social and the cultural change that comes from society. That's what this is. And it's already started, and that ball's rolling already in terms of the people's awareness about climate change, animal welfare, all these different things. But the size of the meat industry itself is astronomical. So if you think, you know, you talked about what is the size of this market today, and basically it's, you know, impossible, and these guys have got sales in the market, but that's all plant-based. If you go to alternative proteins, like the corn and these meat-based markets, the easiest thing to do is look at how much money is being invested in developing those businesses rather than thinking about the size of the market. The size of the market's about 4 or 5 billion quid, you know, as a complete market.
What's today. This for? Corn?
Not just corn. That whole sort of vegan, vegetarian type market is about $4 or $5 billion. Right. And then the meat alternative market, So the plant-based alternatives that are targeted not at vegans and vegetarians, but at you and me. So that the things that look like meat taste like meat, because I don't know a vegan or a vegetarian that wants to eat a meat substitute.
Yeah.
You know, they're not interested in stuff that bleeds like a burger but is comprises plants. The way beyond that. So it's about $5 or $6 billion for that plant-based alternative as well. So there's about $10 billion market today in
that
whole.
Is this world or UK?
World.
Okay.
Against a trillion dollar market for meat alone.
Okay.
Yeah. So you then look at how much has been invested in these companies. So these cellular agriculture is the class. These are the people that are growing proteins in fermenters and in laboratories. And over the last sort of 5 years, about $1 billion or over $1 billion has been invested in these companies. And there's about 50 or 60 companies globally that are doing developments in these areas. And that's everything from a university spin out to people like Perfect Day, who are making proteins that they're mixing, dairy proteins that they're putting in ice cream now, and you can go and buy in the supermarkets. So they're sort of global franchises now, or global market leaders. And then you have people like one of the companies that you mentioned earlier, High Stakes, who were just a university spin out in the UK. They've just gone through their first funding round, so raising small numbers of millions to do the development of their product. But over $1 billion has been invested in the last few years in these industries to get them to market, to overcome some of the challenges that they've got. And you know, pound for a penny, you'll see that the prices will come down massively as the technology develops, and the technology will develop quite rapidly with those sums of money being invested. And that money is largely coming from, the sort of Silicon Valley lot across on the West Coast of America. But you also have a lot of the big food industry, you know, the big companies that control the meat supply chain. They're investing in these companies. And then you have sort of more entrepreneurial funds like Temasek who are based in Singapore, who are spread betting across multiple companies in this area. and investing in, you know, several organizations across those different classes of markets. So there is a thriving investment industry that will mean that we will solve these problems over the next couple of years to end up to get the price point right, that these can have an impact into the meat supply chain. But an impact on a $1 trillion market is going to be, you know, 5% is an impact.
Yeah.
10% is an impact. The $1 trillion meat market is phenomenal. You know, and I've captured some numbers there. So just to give you an idea, there's 1.5 billion cattle around the world.
Right. That's a lot.
24 billion chickens.
A lot.
Yeah, it's just, you know, a billion
humans. There's 7 billion humans, is it?
Just under seven, yeah.
So it's like, okay, three times as many chickens as. So they're very successful animal. Let's face it. I mean, I hate to say this because people will hate me for saying this, but they've made themselves tasty, and now because of that, they're absolutely thriving as a species. So, I mean, whether it's a good way to thrive, a very short lifespan, and you're slaughtered for to be eaten, but they are. So, I mean, it's like
I can sense the outrage coming from a percentage of the population now in terms of this conversation. But the reality is, the majority, certainly in the UK, of people eat meat. If they like, I'll reference my wife, and if she listens to this, she'll absolutely kill me. My wife eats dinner. Everyone's flexitarian, whether they like it or not, because everyone eats bits of salad and bits of veggie on the side of the plate next to the meat. As a rule, there's always something on there. And if they like my wife, they'll eat the meat with bits of the veggie and everything else. And once the meat's gone, anything left on the plate gets left.
Right. Really? Okay.
Because the salad and the veg is the accompaniment to the meat is the main portion of the main part of the meal. That's how we've been brought up. That's what we're, you know, that's just part of our diet and what's going on. But if you go to a place like China, the aspiration in developing worlds is to increase the amount of meat in your diet.
Mm.
So it's an aspiration for the majority of the world's population to increase their meat consumption. So unless you want to start growing that trillion significantly, finding these alternative ways of producing meat-like products, meat-like proteins that enable people to have a healthy and sustainable diet. There's real longevity in that. There's real opportunity in that, especially when you take into account things like, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions, the water consumption. Can I give you some numbers?
Yeah, go on.
Right, so again, this is all researchable. Anyone that's got access to Google can go and find these numbers, because to be fair, that's all I did on Sunday night. I mentioned 1.5 billion cows. For every kilogram of protein from a cow, there are 200 to 300 kilograms of carbon dioxide emissions associated with that. Now, that doesn't mean anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So to put that into context, you'd have to get in your car and drive 1,000 miles.
Wow.
To have that same
impact.
Impact.
This week's sponsor, Clean Co, creates non-alcoholic alternatives to your favorite four-strength spirits with all the flavor, but a fraction of the calories. Whether you're into gin, rum, vodka, or tequila, Clean Co has a delicious option for you from just 12 calories per serve. Clean Co spirits have over 4,500 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. So head over to clean.co to ditch hangovers and drink clean. The problem with this conversation is there's a war going on at the moment. There's always a war going on between people, but at the moment it's really prevalent amongst what we're eating. It's such a bizarre thing, because throughout the history of time,
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
the human being is just desperate to get calories to survive. As you're saying, parts of the world, they're still doing that. They just want the calories on board to survive. Don't care what we eat, we need to eat it. We've got to a stage in the West where we're now getting so picky with our food that we've got myriad diets, but also we're now going, how, you know, I, in my biology class, I was told I was an omnivore, and that's where it starts. Now there's a million different types of human, some who are just carnivore to some who are vegan. And there's a whole plethora in between. There's a whole range in between. And I sit in between because I do eat a lot of tofu and artificial stuff. You know, I don't ever choose artificial meat. I'm like the vegans, really. I don't choose something which looks like meat. I've never done. I just eat other things, you know, which are just other form of proteins. But yeah, so it's just a sort of like war we start. But I imagine when you're putting the figure up of the beef, you also have to put the figure up of the massive amount of soy to, or the avocados or whatever you have to do to sustain a plant-based diet.
So again, because I'm doing the research, the soy, there's something like 340 to 350 million tons a year of soy produced. Over 80% of that is fed to animals.
Right. Okay.
So you're referencing soy, your tofu, and I drink soy milk now, and a bunch of other things. Yeah, it's tiny in comparison to how much of that soy gets grown to feed the animals that we then use as food and calorific intake. And the percentage, if you look at the sun and conversion of the sun to produce food, because that's the main source of food, photosynthesis and all that kind of good stuff. The conversion of energy, and you mentioned calorific value, by the time it goes through the animal and then gets to our dinner plate, it's fractions of a percent of that original sun's energy in providing that calorific value to us relative to what it was originally when it was grown in the fields as soy. So that's a huge challenge. And if you look at that, again, this number is absolutely staggering. So and I double checked it, and it's how much area is grown globally in agricultural terms to support the meat industry. Either it's because you've got grazing pastures and grazing animals, or you've got things like soy fields and everything else. And it was 30 million square kilometers. And again, that's just a number. It doesn't mean anything to anyone, because it's, you know, 30 kilometers I can picture, because it's from here to my sort of my aunt's house down the road. 30 million square kilometers doesn't mean anything. So I looked at it in terms of land area, and it's basically the land area of Canada, America, and China.
Just for agriculture to feed animals?
Just for our meat industry.
Right.
So that's either the agricultural products or the actual animals themselves.
So in my lifetime, the population of the world has doubled, and the uncomfortable truth is we're spending a lot of time on trying to keep humans alive, and we need to feed humans. That's the deal. So, you know, when you turn on the TV, when they're doing an advert about people in the world starving, they're trying to get food to them. So as the population of the world increases, we need to find a way to feed the people. When there was 3.5 million people when I was born, I'm sure it was a lot easier on the environment with the cattle and everything else, because there wasn't as many people eating it. Now there's more people, but we're, as a human race, we are obsessed with, quite rightly, with our survival and health, and also making everybody else in the world survive, and everybody live longer. Everybody's allowed to have, you know, there's hardly any infant mortality. The infant mortality rates are right down in this country to pretty much, you know, tiny figures, which is fantastic. That's happening all over the world too. It's great, but with it, we need to eat. And what we need to eat is stuff that is, at the moment, stuff that is alive. So we have to kill stuff to eat it, whether it be vegetables or whatever. But now we've got to a stage which is the bit that fascinates me, where we go, actually, we can just start growing it. What does the industry actually look like? You know, what are we actually seeing? I mean, you say brewing. I mean, is it a big metal container we're looking at? What?
Yeah. So you mentioned corn earlier. Quorn has been around, the technology for Quorn has been around since the early 80s, and they've been actually operating on Teesside, where I'm based. I've actually been up there fermenters. These are just basically, if you imagine a cylinder
that is, I can't tell, 8 to 10 stories high.
Yeah. And it's got a little loop on the side, and it's called an airlift fermenter. And what you do is you inject lots of oxygen and air in at the bottom, and this just causes a big natural draft. So it causes sort of reforced circulation around around this little loop, and you feed it sugar, and the bugs eat the sugar and the nutrients that you put in there. They put some water in, and they take an off stream, which has the product in it, and that runs for sort of 30 days at a time before they have to turn it round. And that is just basically a 5-story rocket ship. Just think of it as a rocket, five sort of 8 to 10 stories high. It's about 200 cubic meters. Again, that doesn't mean anything in terms of numbers. It's just a bloody big tank. And they've got multiple of these sat next to each other. And their business is thriving that much that they're expanding and building more. And on a different part of Teesside, so that's their industrial site where they actually do the brewing. And it is exactly that. They're brewing protein from sugar. So they're taking carbohydrate, which is abundant all over the world, in the form of sugar and glucose, and they're converting that glucose into the quorn protein, which is a yeast called fusarium. And they then take that out, dewater it, concentrate it up into a paste, take it to a different factory on another part of Teesside, where they then turn it into a myriad of recipes and package it, which you can go and buy from your local supermarket. And that's the process. It is that simple. But they supply globally these products from Teesside. And that they've got a global brand. They sell in a variety of different countries around the world. And it all comes out of one factory in Billingham on Teesside, where they actually manufacture the stuff. And then they take the ingredient that comes out of the fermenter. So think of it as an ingredient that comes out of the fermenter, the protein. That's just an ingredient. And they take it to a different factory, which is all under food grade, high hygiene standards and everything else, where the operators wear hair nets and all the other kind of good stuff. And they turn that ingredient into a recipe, which is your chicken nuggets, your sausages, and your corn lasagna and all the other kind of stuff that you can go and buy from the supermarket.
I'm going to ask you a question here, and you don't have to answer it, and it might be not a fair question, so I don't know if you're qualified to answer this, but is it healthy? You said it's made out of sugar and carbohydrate. I mean, I just because those words have been demonized for me, I'm just going, whoa, hold on a second, I don't want to eat that if it's made out of sugar. And so are the has
no sugar's an ingredient. Most people drink alcohol doesn't contain sugar. It comes from sugar. So it's our bodies take sugar and they produce the energy that we have to operate and all the rest of it. We want sugar again is one of these sort of demonized terms. The bad sugar is sucrose because it doesn't have a lot of different nutritional value. Good sugar, if you want to use that generic term of sugar, is an oligosaccharide, which is fiber. So fiber is just sugar. If you break it down small enough, it's just sugar. It's just a big, long polymer of glucose chains. But if you take fiber, by the time that gets into your intestinal tract and it works its way through, it feeds your microbiome and is really, really good for you. So sugar is one of those terms that's demonized because people have usually got an agenda when they're doing it. But in reality, it's, you know, there are good sugars and there are bad sugars. And bad sugars are the white sugar that you've got that you put in your tea. That's great. But if you start eating it by the spoonful or rolling some butter in it just because you want a sweet treat, that's probably bordering on unhealthy.
As I say, though, there's a dumb war which goes on with all these things. You know, I mean, if you are one of those people who's taken a side and hates the other side, then you've got to step in the shoes of the other people. But there was a recent article, it was only this week, where they said that, again, as I want to reiterate, there's a war going on. So where this information's come from, I don't know, but they've decided that vegans, children, are 1.2 inches shorter than meat-eating children. And that's what they wrote as an article the other day. And I thought that's really interesting that they're putting that sort of stuff in the press, because I don't know whether it comes from the meat industry or it comes from actual science or whatever, but it just seems like a strange thing to put in, because that is threatening people's children, isn't it?
It's like you say, it's a narrative. And who's pushing the narrative? And who's, you know, how many layers behind it does the funding come? And, you know, sometimes there's things that are adverts and it's written up in the top corner or whatever else it would be. So I can't comment on that. But the reality is, it's I take anything like that with a pinch of salt, because you know it depends entirely on there's so many other factors that get involved in that kind of thing. But yeah, it's you know I'm vegetarian 2/3 of the day. I eat a plant-based breakfast, I eat a plant-based lunch, but I eat dinner with my wife and kids. So usually I either eat what's cooked for me, or my wife leaves it out on the top and I'm cooking, and then I cook what I've been told to cook for dinner. And because the six of us eating that, I get I eat what's been told. So the statistics out there and what people will do to bend the statistics to try and promote an agenda is probably why I don't watch much news now.
Chris, you said you take it with a pinch of salt. Careful, you don't take too much salt, mate. It's not good for you. Just on the health angle, though, and because you're trying to get these guys to market who are making. I mean, you can tell us about some of the businesses you're dealing with, if you like. But these sort of things that people are doing, is protein just protein just protein? Does it matter? Can I have all those versions of protein you gave us at the beginning? I know some of them are just for animals and some of them for humans. If I was to sit down every night and have corn or one of the other examples you give me or meat, is it all pretty much the same? Am I going to live more or laboratory meat? Am I going to live pretty much the same way?
Difficult question. The food proteins have to be approved. There's a huge regulatory process that I think takes about 7 years to get novel foods and new foods into the market and the human food chain. So this stuff gets absolutely rigorously tested. Protein is a word that is used that describes a huge class of compounds.
Right.
So protein isn't a protein. Protein is like thousands of different compounds that do a range of different things. And a protein is a polymer of these things called amino acids. And I'm not a biologist, and I have known in the past, and my colleagues are going to now tear me apart when they see me next. I can't remember how many amino acids there are. There's some dozens of amino acids in the world. And a protein is basically a polymer chain. So what's a polymer chain? A polymer chain is just multiple of a unit combined together. And you can have 10, you can have 100, you can have 1,000, you can have 100,000, you can have a million of these units put together, which forms a polymer chain. The different polymer chains with their different component amino acids in there give different properties and functional properties to that protein. But we have proteins that act as chemical catalyst reactors, or chemical catalysts in reactors. We have proteins that we eat that feed us. And you couldn't eat a protein that was used in a chemical reaction because it wouldn't necessarily give you any benefit. But the other types of proteins you eat. So protein is a huge range of molecules, not just meat, not just food. It means many, many different things. And I'm not qualified to give the detail on what they would be.
What sort of things are you working on or looking at? What sort of things are you seeing come your way at the moment?
So we've got, so interestingly, the sugar element. So the guys are looking at making sugar. How do you make sugar? It's not sugar, it's making sweeteners. So there are proteins in the world that are 1,000 times more sweet than the sugar that you would buy from Tate and Lyle or whoever in your kilo bag in the supermarket. And if you think it's 1,000 times sweeter, well, how do you get that on a teaspoon? Then they fill it full of maltodextrin and the other fillers to make sure it's enough. But it doesn't have the calorific content. So that product is coming through. It's coming through CPI now. It's an organization called Magellan Life Sciences. We've just closed some funding to enable them to go right the way through from lab scale to pilot scale production of this material. And that's brilliant. There's another company in Israel called Amai Protein doing exactly the same thing. Their products are slightly different, but they're multiple companies working in the same market because they're taking sugar. They're taking sucrose or glucose or whatever else and brewing the proteins out of it. And they get proteins which then have a much, much more beneficial impact on us. So we're not intaking sort of useless calories in the form of white sugar. Other companies that we're working with, so there's a couple that are doing very similar things. Deep Branch Biotechnology are a company that are based in Nottingham and working on in the Netherlands. These guys are taking carbon dioxide.
Right, so here's one for you. Talk about greenhouse gases and carbon footprint of the meat industry and everything else. How about taking carbon dioxide and hydrogen that you've generated through a solar cell or you've got a windmill. You do some electrolysis to generate some hydrogen using renewable power. You put the hydrogen and the carbon dioxide into a fermenter. This particular microbe eats the carbon dioxide and hydrogen and grows. So by growing, it just doubles and then doubles again and doubles again. You can recover that protein and turn it into animal feed, take it up to Scotland, feed it into your salmon farm, and grow salmon from carbon dioxide.
Oh, sorry, you're making food out of air.
You're making food out of air.
What's this company called? Jesus Inc.
No, well, to be fair, there's a number of organisations in the world doing similar things. So there's Solar Food in Scandinavia. There's Kiverdi, or Air Protein, as they're called now, in California. There's Deep Branch Biotech, who are a UK-based company. And they're all got technology that was first thought of in the 1960s by NASA.
Right. Because
if you go into space, what have you got?
Nothing.
You've got photons from the sun, and you've got the CO2 you've just breathed out. So if you've got the photons from the sun, a bit of water, and the CO2 you've just breathed out, I can make food, in theory.
They can recycle 97% of the water on the International Space Station. That includes your wee.
No, and that's what you've got. That's the thing. So yeah. NASA started doing that in the 60s. But it's the microbe itself. I don't know if you listen. Is it the Big Bang Theory? And I watched it yesterday specifically. So I hope someone goes and double checks. But the planet we live on today was terraformed by microbes back in like 10 million years ago or whatever it was. And they're called autotrophs. And it's actually mentioned in the theme tune to the start on the Big Bang Theory. The autotroph started multiplying, and then something else happened and man appeared. And these autotrophs are these molecules that they take carbon dioxide and under the right conditions grow. Under different sets of conditions, they produce oxygen.
Yeah.
Which is where the Earth came from, or the environment that we currently live in. So it's reinventing and using nature repeatedly.
So the thing is, it's about society taking it seriously, isn't it, and getting involved in it and wanting to do it. And the big point, whenever I say laboratory meat, I always say I can't wait for it to happen. Everyone says, oh, I'm not doing that, it's processed. I'm not doing it. I wouldn't eat that, it's processed. I'm not touching anything from a lab. And I think that's a real pushback. We've been so, again, like I talk about sugars, how we've demonized the word sugar and we've demonized carbohydrates sometimes. We've demonized processed food, haven't we? It's like, eat like any of the chefs, eat a healthy diet, don't eat anything processed. Well, actually, you know, this is the whole marketplace that opening up, because that's all it is processed food, really.
I don't get me wrong, I eat crisps. I eat food that comes through. I've got four kids, you know, they only eat chicken nuggets. But I do think that there is a real risk that in 20 years' time, we'll look back at the diet of the 90s, noughties, and now, and we'll have shifted and we'll have moved forward as all these technologies evolve. And there will be some acknowledgements about the ultra-refined and processed foods that we were all eating, the high, very high salt contents, the sugar contents, and whatever else, and the impact that that's had on the health services in the developed nations. So that's a concern for me. I have no facts to substantiate it. It's just a concern and
opinion. All right. So you're saying there's a difference between the processed foods that you're talking about, which is brewed protein, and the crap that they're giving you in fast food restaurants or the crisps or confectionaries. Yeah. That's what you're saying, right?
Because a lot of what we're talking about is actually natural processes.
Right, okay.
So I can go in the garden. If I was a good enough microbiologist, I could go in the garden, forage around in the soil somewhere and get the microbe that corn manufacture and sell. You can go and get it from the environment. It's a natural product, which is why these things have got organic status. They've got kosher and halal status. They've gone through those processes. They're natural products that are just being put into a specific environment that enables them to thrive and grow, to the point where it becomes industrially viable, in the same way that, you know, having half a dozen chickens and scattering them around and throwing the corn out the window to feed them is no longer a viable way of you know, producing eggs in the UK, because we consume 11 billion eggs a year in the UK. We've got 42 million broiler hens in the UK producing eggs,
cool.
Right? So it's not credible anymore for everyone to own a chicken in the back garden, feed it with bits of corn or breadcrumbs or whatever else it will be, and take their egg a day, because there's a massive industry behind it. So all this is just industrialized what nature already does. These organisms already exist. They're already probably on your hands if you've been out doing gardening, but it's just getting it into an environment and then putting some flavors on it to make it taste nice, and you get all the nutritional benefit from it.
I don't want to, I'm not stitching you up here, so you don't need to answer this at all, but you've talked about halal there and stuff. I wonder how the religious organizations are going to take meat which is made in a laboratory, or I mean, I'm sure the artificial, the corns and stuff are fine, but actually to take it out of an animal, because it needs to be blessed, doesn't it, and slaughtered or something. I wonder if it will be able to be labeled as halal.
So again, doing my research, I anticipated this one, that it's currently with the theologians that are in the sort of the Islamic faith. So there are people seriously considering this question now that are out there actually doing the research that's necessary. And a lot of it is to do with the ingredients that come into the fermenter.
Right.
So providing that the animal that the original cells were taken from is either still alive or was butchered via the halal mechanism, or is alive and is kept and maintained in the kind of halal traditions, and then all of the ingredients that come into the fermentation, so the nutrient sources, the carbohydrate source, whatever else that's required, they're looking at the different ranges and sources of that stuff, and it'll go through an assessment process. Once the theologians got the head around it, they'll come up with sets of criteria and a framework, and it'll be a quality standard in the same way that anything that gets produced to halal now is a quality standard.
Do they grow the laboratory meat the same way as you're talking about? Are they sort of fermenting the cells? Really? So they're making it in huge, great, big vats?
Well, not today, because that's why they're not knocking it out, and that's why you can't go and buy chicken nuggets in the supermarket freezer at that scale. And that's why I'm saying the guys in Singapore are doing it as a loss leader. These things are still at the kind of it'll take me a week to make a chicken nugget perspective. Right. Well, don't know about you, but I get paid more than $11 or $23 a week. So it's not credible that you can do it at that kind of scale. But they're in the journey of scaling up and doing a thing called scaling out in fermentation. So you can't just your vessels just can't get bigger and bigger and bigger, especially on the more complex fermentations. So you do what's called, you scale up to a certain size, and then you do what's called scale out, which is have multiple of the same thing sat next to each other. And then so instead of having one uber fermenter, what Quorn are doing now, they've got one big fermenter, then they grew to two fermenters, and now they've got four or five fermenters that they've got sat next to each other, all feeding the same kind of downstream, producing the ingredients and feeding the same downstream kind of processing. So there's that scale out mentality. And that's one of the challenges, in that the animal cells, the mammalian cells are a really complex cell. They're far more complex than the microbial cell or the fungal cell that's corn. So you have to be a lot more gentle in growing them. And that's what the journey is now that these guys are getting investment in, is they're going through that process development and scale up technologies. And that's why it costs millions, hundreds of millions, and will eventually be billions by the time that the manufacturing facilities get put on the ground for these kinds of products. It isn't straightforward, but the upside that I think will happen one day, because of the investments that are happening here, I think, and again, it's very much personal opinion, the breakthroughs that these guys will have, stimulated by the food market, will flow backwards into the medical market. Typically, you'll get trickle down from high value markets into lower value commodity markets. Because of the focus on cellular agriculture today, I think some of the technology breakthroughs they have will enable us to do things like print organs in the future. So I can grow a kidney, I can grow a liver, I'll be able to grow some muscle tissue that can then be grafted on by taking someone's existing cell going away. So someone who's been injured in a road traffic accident or got a disease, and be able to do that. So this might be 20, 30, 40 years down the line, but I do think there will be some backflow from the food industry developments today that will impact medicine in the future as a consequence of the manufacturing techniques and structures and everything that come out of what's done now.
Well, they've already said, if we're going to make protein in labs, why don't we make it out of ourselves? We become a nation of cannibals. That's what we should do. Make human protein, and then it's probably easy for us to process. It's just why
not? I think I'll turn vegan before we go down that one.
I wonder what the driver will be. I mean, you've got three drivers, haven't you? You've got animal welfare, health, and you've got environmental. If I was to choose my top two, I'd probably go for health number one, because that's what interests me, my health most, like every human out there, even though some will say they care about other things first, I suppose. And I think then animal welfare, and then the environment, because it's too big and I don't understand it. I mean, I really care about the environment, but it's so huge that the issues out there that I don't quite understand it. Interestingly, on the health thing, I off my show, I started drinking what are they called, soy lattes, because I'd had, was it, no, almond milk latte, almond milk white, flat white or something, because I'd had it on my show and I'd never had one before, and then I sort of kept on doing it. Then one day I went into Starbucks and had one, and it was like really sweet. And I was like, what is this? And they said, oh, they put a lot of sugar in there and their one. And I looked at the ingredients of one of those milks. Wow, there's a lot of stuff goes into that. And I was like, so I stopped drinking it. Not because I don't know anything about it. I was just like, hold on, there's 7 or 8 ingredients going into make my almond milk. I'm not doing it. And so I stopped drinking it, because I was like, well, it's probably just packed full of sugar and stuff like that. And I like to try and keep my food simple. And so my driver for why I want to move into the world of artificial protein is a health thing. I actually believe laboratory brewed, either fake protein or animal protein, whatever it is, you know, not fake protein, but the protein you're
alternative proteins, the industrial word for it's alternative protein.
I believe they'll probably be healthier for me in the long run, but I could be wrong.
The challenge is exactly as you've said. It's what comes out of the fermenter is an ingredient. What then happens to that ingredient as it moves its way through the formulation chemistry that calls it, that results in it becoming a recipe that gets packaged in something that you then find in the supermarket, flipping it over and reading the ingredient label, you know, learning to cook. It comes back to the simplistic things. If you have a little bit of everything in your diet, you're going to be all right. It's when you overdo one particular thing that you'll usually have a problem. I mean, you know, to the extreme, marathon runners have died because they've drowned themselves because they've diluted out all the electrolytes. You know, if you do anything to an extreme, you're going to have problems. But if you have a little bit of everything in your diet, you know, they talk about colours, and if you can have a rainbow of different colours, whether it's your peppers and all this kind of stuff, and not everyone likes that kind of stuff, but in reality, your body is a machine. It needs all these different tools and these different medicines that are in the plants and instruments and everything else. No, instruments, plants and things that you eat that enable your body to function. And it's reality is we've been doing it for thousands of years. It's only in the last 20 or 30 years we've stopped doing it.
And so, what do you think will be the driver? I mean, environment's a big driver for people at the moment, isn't it? And let's envisage a future. What do you think? I'll put you on the spot here. Where do you think we're going to go? We're definitely going to move away from animal meat at some stage, I think. Don't you think we're going to move towards that being just a sort of, I mean, I hate to say this, it feels crass saying it, but a treat to eat an animal rather than a daily thing to be doing?
Yeah, and I don't see harm in that, to be honest. But that requires the government and everyone else to get on board with taxations and whatever else, because right now they can produce chicken nuggets, they can produce chicken breasts at about £1 a kilo. You go into supermarkets and you're paying £5 or £6 a kilo for meat. I've do the shopping and I've had a look, and that's about £5 or £6 a kilo. Whether if I want prime sirloin steak, it might be £10 a kilo. If I want chicken breasts, it's £5 a kilo. That's an incredibly advantaged price point that the efficiency of the food system has got the price of meat down to. You've either got to outcompete that material or provide some kind of dissuasion via taxation or whatever else to change the behavior. I mean, look what happened with carrier bags. Started charging for them at the checkout and practically everyone stopped using them. So it does work when you trigger the right responses and communicate correctly with society. However, go and picking up half a dozen chicken breasts to feed your family for £5, and you've got a nice meal out of it, and everyone's nice and happy and healthy and whatever else. that's a real difficult position to compete with when you're bringing a new product onto the market. And, oh, am I going to buy these Quorn? What brand's that? Or what's this funny material that's in here now? It looks like chicken nuggets. Looks like a chicken breast, but, you know, my wife won't eat chicken out of a freezer, out the freezer section in supermarkets. It's all right if we get fresh chicken and freeze it ourselves, but she won't eat frozen chicken out of the supermarket because it's got a different texture. So it's different to different people's tastes and palates.
Yeah,
and it's unusual.
God, sorry.
When it's unusual or when it's different, oh, don't like that. And then you never go back to it.
Yeah, or we'll leave it now, and I'll just leave it on one thing that makes me smile. The one thing we haven't talked about is insects, which is a huge protein that we're always told that we're always going to be eating. And I got lucky enough to try a tarantula burger on Sunday brunch once, which didn't look anything like tarantulas, by the way. It wasn't crushed up tarantulas. It was the protein from spiders, basically, which they'd made into a sort of burger pâté, and I was eating it. And Will I Am was on the show, and he said, I ain't eating no tarantula burger. And I just thought that was really, really good. He couldn't get his head around the idea. And I've eaten so many insects and crap because of my show that I'm just used to eating it. And I think if it's edible, I'm fine eating grasshoppers and everything. I don't mind, but people cannot get their head round it. And I think, you know, that's half a battle with all these things, isn't it? People getting their head round anything which isn't what they normally think they're going to eat.
In a different life, I spent a lot of time in China on business trips and everything else. And because you were usually on a business trip, being a visitor, whoever we were visiting, doing business, they'd take us out for a banquet. And it's like if let them eat. It's like if you go out and you've got visitors, you take them for a meal, and you know it's a one off meal for you, and it's everything. But we're getting these one off meals twice a day, which you know was the banquets. And I learned to eat with chopsticks using my peripheral vision, because I didn't want to see what I was actually putting in my mouth. Because in China, they still feed you the whole animal, whether it's a bird, whether it's a fish, and you're eating cicada and grasshoppers and scorpions and snakes. So eating without actually looking at your food became interesting challenge. But for a lot of the world, insects are already a staple part of the diet. And you can go on Amazon, because again, after our conversation, I did it. You can go on Amazon and buy a kilo of insect flour and get it delivered to your house now. It's just, you know, that flour has a protein composition that's not too dissimilar to wheat flour or rice flour, and you can just include it in your recipes. It doesn't bear a resemblance to an insect. If you on your show just gave a chef three piles of flour and said, go make X, Y, and Z, you know, that'd be a great thing. You know, it'd be a great thing for a blind cook test and a blind taste test. And only afterwards, when everyone's tasted and eaten everything, you tell them what the actual ingredients were and food. You know, that'd be quite funny in a sadistic kind of way. But those products are already out there. There's companies out there, I don't know the names, but I understand what they're doing with the black fly larvae and everything else. And these are sort of hermetically sealed warehouses, effectively, that are just machines that grow the larvae, grow them into flies, take them out, euthanize the sort of population, and then grind it up and do what's necessary to take it into a food grade standard. And that's what those words are the key point: food grade standard. Testing and rigor that goes into having something approved for human consumption is phenomenal. So it comes down to your palate and whether you want to eat it or not, not whether or not it's safe and healthy for you, usually with these materials.
True.
Tested to death.
It's really weird, though, isn't it? The idea that we grow something, we don't let it fly around, we just kill it, grow it, kill it, grow it, kill it. I mean, like, it just doesn't sit well. That's why I think this artificial, I mean, we're doing the same, I suppose, with the stuff that we're growing, which we're going to put into, I don't know, it's just a weird world we're in. And we're, as humans, we're starting to get concerned about welfare of everything. I mean, we'll have welfare issues with fungus, won't we, eventually? Because it's the way we're going. So, you know,
certainly microbial rights.
Yeah, exactly.
There's intelligence in the microbes.
Do they have a soul, Chris? I must say, by the way, on this, because I know it's quite a heated subject, and people get very angry and very anxious about this. I change my mind constantly on these issues, and And hopefully, if you enjoyed this conversation, you can write to us and let us know what you think. But don't get angry, because it's just a conversation we're having about food. And, you know, obviously, it's the most important thing. We all need to do it every day. And I think things are changing. It's interesting. If you get a chance, I'd go to the CPI website, because I think it's really exciting, the world you inhabit. It's an interesting world, isn't it? You've got going on there.
It's never the same on two days. It's, you know, the customers that we have, the stage of the process that the customers are in, and the technologies that they bring to us, and then we get to share our experience and knowledge to get them through the journey faster. And by faster, inevitably, it's cheaper and the products get to market sooner. That's the key, and that's why we're here. But it does offer some interesting perspectives. And, you know, we're driving for food grade status right now with our Novel Food Innovation Centre that we're hoping to close some funding with Tees Valley Combined Authority, because entrepreneurs are buggers. You know, people can come to us and say, oh, will you grow this for us? And it's like, yeah, fine, that's not a problem. It's not food grade. Yeah, but it'll be all right. I'll taste it. It'll be fine. The CEOs of the companies that we work with, they want to validate and demonstrate to their investors that the material is great, so they'll eat it. And that's a challenge for us as an organization, because we're having to drive a food grade internal registration, because the proteins that we help the customers, that we grow for the customers, and the ingredients that we grow and ferment for the customers, they want to take out and put into recipes. Because, you know, the real way to get someone to invest in your business is to show them how good your product tastes in a lasagna, or how good your chicken nugget is, or whatever else it will be. And that's not straightforward in terms of liabilities and business and all the rest of it. So it's a real interesting journey that we're on with our different customers. And we're seeing a massive explosion in the US, in the UK, and in Europe. And in Israel and in Singapore, in these organizations and companies driving the alternative proteins across those five different sectors that we talked about. And it's phenomenal. And it's in the supermarkets now, and it will continue to grow, because, as you say, there is that societal movement is moving in those directions for whatever drivers, whether it's environmental, health, or animal welfare. And we're getting there, and we'll get there, and it'll continuously grow. And the meat industry is investing in them. So they view that, you know, if that's happening, they acknowledge that this is happening. So let's get involved, and as a business, we'll continue to thrive. So it's getting support by the right players. So it is the future. It isn't all of the future. You'll still always be able to get meat. I'm confident of that. But, you know, maybe in 5 years' time, you'll be able to buy alternative proteins on the supermarket shelf or the Moza Meat burgers.
I've got to say, Chris, I think it's going to happen really quickly. I'm seeing it. I'm seeing the way it's going, and I think it's going to rapidly happen. I think all the chefs will get involved in it, it's ready. It's right, and I think we're not a million miles away from society accepting it as a daily thing to put in their diet. Which form it takes, I don't know, but I think it's going to come. Fascinating, though, Chris. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've thoroughly enjoyed this hour. I've learned loads. So thank you so much, Chris. Hopefully we can do it again in a year's or so time and see what's moving on, where we're going.
Yeah, absolutely. And any other topics, scientific-y type, that you're interested in, if we've got anything to offer on that, I'll be able to lean in or get one of our experts to come and have a chat with you.
Cheers, Chris.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.